There's a body shop just off Southwest Boulevard, around the corner from a strip of Mexican restaurants. It appears closed from the outside, but inside? Are the skeletons of cars. The air is dimly lit and heavy with fumes of oil, grease, and paint. In the back of the shop is a 1964 Impala.
This is one of our project cars that we're working on. We built a ground-up frame-off restoration. It's got chrome on the carriage, and it is a pretty metallic blue.
Tim Lona has spent a year and a half turning this car into a lowrider. It takes a lot of time. You have to gut, strip, and sand a car down to the bare bones before reassembling it with custom wheels so that it sits low to the ground. How low?
Oh, it will go very low. Very, very low. Almost sitting on the ground.
Tim first started working on lowriders with his dad back in the late 80s.
At one time, we would have 5, 6, 7 lowriders out front. And I'd have 3 more in here, and I'm working on all of them. And people would just come by and just look at the cars. And, you know, I had people who would just drive by to see what I had here at the shop. You know, they would just, oh, wow, let's go by Lona's and see what they got.
There's an art to what Tim does and a whole culture behind the low-riding phenomenon. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to find out more about it. I'm Gina Kaufman in the studio now with Tim Lona. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
So your shop is on the west side. Did you grow up there?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about your upbringing.
Well, I come from a 3-generation mechanic family. We've been on the west side, my family, since about 1912, right around in there. Always had a business
there.
So
for a while.
A while.
Was there a lowrider culture on the west side that you were exposed to as a kid, or did that come later?
We had a couple of guys, a gentleman named Boss Ledesma. He had a lowrider. I loved his car.
What did it look like to you when you first saw it?
His was a 63 Impala, and he had customized it quite a bit. And he had chopped the top, and he had his grill was tubed. And, yeah, it was a neat-looking car. You know, we were talking 1984, he had a car like that.
And so how did you personally start getting interested beyond just seeing him go by?
Well, I was a teenager, and when I was bugging my dad for a car, and I was like, I got to have a car. I got to get around. Being a dad at that time, he was like, hey, I'm not going to buy you one. You have to build your own. I got a car out back.
You have to buy your own, but you have to build your own.
You got to build it. And he goes, there's a 64 Impala back I'll give you. At the time, I really didn't know what I had. It was a car with 4 wheels, get me around. I was happy with that. It was a middle winter, blizzard. Me and my brother went back there, dug the car out, pulled it around, and just tore into it. I had my grandfather help me rebuild the engine. My dad helped me rebuild the brakes, got everything mechanically sound on it. And there you go. I had my first car, 64 Chevy Impala SS. It was ugly. Very ugly, but it was mine.
Did it need to be rebuilt, or were you rebuilding it for aesthetics? It sounds like it needed to be rebuilt.
It needed help. Yes, it was long in the tooth. It needed help. So,
how did lowriders enter the picture for you?
I had a buddy of mine that was helping me. He was younger than I was, but he was coming in and helping me out as much as he could. And he goes, Tim, I'm going to bring you something that you need to see. And he showed up the next day with a lowrider magazine. And in there was all these Impalas like mine with fancy paint jobs and rims and hydraulics, and I just fell in love. That was it. It was on for me.
I know it's hard to describe why anyone falls in love with anything. Something just happens. But do you know what it was about these images that really spoke to you?
Yeah, it was the culture. It was the culture. You saw all these Mexican Americans together having a great time, doing something positive, and their cars were just amazing, amazing, amazing. So I was like, I want to be like that.
If you were talking to someone who had somehow managed to never see a lowrider and just had absolutely no idea what we were talking about, how would you explain what a lowrider is?
I would tell them it's a work of art. It is your passion, it's your vision, and it's a work of art that comes from you.
Is there, how do you make a car ride low?
You put hydraulics on it. Well, now they got airbags, but back then it was mostly hydraulics, which is a hydraulic pump with hydraulic cylinders, runs off fluid, and is powered by batteries. You know, it could be just from two batteries all the way up to 10 to 12, 14 batteries, depending on what you're doing.
So with it being a work of mechanics and a work of art, how do these two things come together for you?
Well, that's a good question. You know, you do have to have some talent, you know, to what you're doing. When I first started, it was trial and error. Nobody taught me. There was little tricks that I learned along the way. I was not a great painter. I was not a great body man. I didn't do interior, but I was willing to learn. And, you know, you network, you meet people, you do favors, and next thing you know, you got people to help you do whatever you want on a car.
So if you were talking about the art of painting, like, on a canvas, some of the things you might talk about would be like, you know, the texture of the paint on the surface, or creating shadow and creating perspective and things like that. What would be kind of the different elements of the art of the lowrider? What are some of the skills you really have to have?
Well, on the paint, it's just like if you're painting anything else, there's so many different techniques, so many colors, so many ideas that no one car is exactly the same. Some guys want to put murals, pictures. Some just want straight colors. Some want a flake. Some want all of it. Some guys put everything together. You know, it's just what you want. And and some of that is very, very hard to do. Very hard. I can't master all that. I bring people in to help me on certain things. So, you know, it's just level what you want to do.
You mentioned that it was the culture you really fell in love with. Tell me more about the culture around these objects, these cars.
Well, you have car clubs, you have associations. You know, in the Lowrider magazine, they had a section of just the picnics and the stuff that went on with the picnics. And
then picnics?
You know, you would go to a park with all your Lowrider buddies, and you'd have a picnic. And you would have, you know, you cook out and just like have a great time and show off your car. And then they also had a lot of a section where they did a lot of fundraisers, raising money for cancer, raising money for toys, for kids, stuff like that. To me, reading that magazine was, everything about it was positive, very positive, and I loved it.
What is it about riding in one of these cars that people enjoy? I mean, I've seen them going by, but I've never ridden in one myself.
Well, that's hard to describe. That is so hard to describe. If you ever get a chance, you have to ride in a lowrider. The attention you get, it's just fun. It's just fun. I mean, you go low and slow or high and slow, or there's cars at three wheel, which is where one wheel's off the ground and you're cruising on three wheels. I mean, there's hopping where you actually hop the car. People love it. I mean, I just went through the plaza last Sunday. And when I was with my son, and we were having to play some really nice R&B music, and there was people dancing on both sides of the street, and giving us the thumbs up, you know, really just enjoying my car.
For you, is the excitement more in the process of transforming the car or driving it when it's done?
Both. Actually, both. I mean, once I'm done with it, I go, wow, I did this, and then now I can drive it. You know, of course, I do a lot of customers' cars, you know, I just hand them off to them, but... And even then, I feel very proud because they love their car.
Well, we'd love to hear from other lowrider aficionados out there. Call in and tell us about the car you can't forget and what it meant to you. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. And Tim Lona, tell me about some of the lowriders you've worked on in your shop that you thought were really cool, like the ones you will never forget.
The one I think will always, there's two of them. One is... a friend of mine that I built a 64 Impala convertible. They did a story on it in the Kansas City Star. A friend of mine named CJ owns it. We built that one ground up, and it was beautiful. And it's like the icon car, 64 Impala SS 409 engine.
Help me picture it.
It's candy apple red, long, convertible, bright white interior, and everything's chrome on it. Everything is shiny, shiny. I mean, you can see the car 10 miles away, just the bling coming at you. That was one. The other one was, I actually did a Monday night football game for the Kansas City Chiefs, a pregame, And I took out there another 64 Impala, but this one was an orange with flake all in it, with gold Daytons on it. And when you saw that car up on the Jumbotron, oh, my God, amazing. I mean, the color was just, you couldn't believe the color. It was just sparkling, and it was great. It was great. It was those two right there. And, of course, mine. I had a 64 purple one. But I get that one a 3.
You only give it a 3?
Yeah, I give it a third place. I give that one third place because those other two were just very, very, very nice cars.
What were some of the proud moments from working on those cars?
Well, you know, those cars open up a avenue to other stuff. I've done commercials. I've done, of course, the Chiefs pregame. I've done, festivals, parades, parties, quinceañeras. I mean, I have done so much stuff just from owning a lowrider and building lowriders. I've been invited, do countless stuff that was just so much fun. I went all over the country doing lowrider shows that I never would have done if I didn't do lowriders.
There's going to be a lowrider parade this weekend at the Latino Arts Festival. And I'm curious, from your perspective, how much is lowrider culture tied up with Latino culture in the U.S. or in Kansas City?
Oh, yeah, nationwide. It originated in the Latino community, on the West Coast and moved this way. It is not just a Latino thing now. Everybody lowrides, every color. I mean, in Japan, there's a huge lowrider culture out there. I mean, when I was selling parts for lowriders, I was selling them to Australia, England, Canada, South America. I was sending parts everywhere. So there's lowriders all over this world.
I want to get another guest in on this. Ben Chappell teaches American Studies at KU, and he's a lowrider scholar. Ben, what got you interested in lowriders to begin with?
Well, thanks, Gina. My interest in lowriders really goes back to my graduate studies and just sort of pursuing my interests in aesthetics and especially popular aesthetics and some of the art forms that aren't taught in school necessarily. I went to the University of Texas and found myself studying in a program that was really all about looking at some of these art forms that people maintain in their own communities, especially the Mexican American community. So I was in the folklore program in Texas in the Department of Anthropology, and the founder of that program, Américo Paredes, really helped found the field of Mexican American studies by studying ballads, the corridos that people sing, and trying to understand society through these cultural art forms. So I had friends who were studying popular religion, who were studying music, all kinds of forms, and I saw a lowrider in Texas drive
just
by
saw
campus.
One go by.
It was actually not a classic lowrider; it was a van, but it was on spoke wheels. And it had graffiti murals all over it. And just the way that car established a presence by campus really intrigued me. And at the time, I was taking my first seminar in Mexican American Studies, and we actually talked about lowriders. We read some of the work that had been done before. There was a scholar, Brenda Bright, who had done her master's and her doctorate on lowriders. So I read a little bit about the history and saw the cars in some movies, and I started looking for people locally who were doing it. I ended up connecting with a car club, and they taught me all about their art form and what it meant to them. I spent a lot of time cruising around with that club.
So why don't you describe also what it's like to ride in a lowrider? Because you came to it as a newbie an outsider. So, yeah.
I can tell you. Well, I think that... my experience is a lot like what Tim said. It's just a thrill. And it was a high point in my research as a graduate student when the first time that somebody invited me
bad.
To ride.
Just go for a sweet ride.
Yeah. No, there's the president of the club that I was with, his name is Alex Vargas. He invited me into his car, which is a 73 Monte Carlo, with the roof chopped off. He had a beautiful hydraulic system, beautiful blue metal flake paint job. And we just started driving around. And I tell you what, it's a summer night and we were in Austin, Texas. We're driving down the main streets. Everybody, as you drive by, everybody's turning to look. And, the city's just sort of unfolding in front of you. And there was nothing like it.
Sounds good. Let's go. Tim, is it odd for you to hear about someone coming to this thing that, I mean, you came to it from a family of mechanics, hands-on, you know, mm-hmm. like part of your whole life. And to hear about someone coming to it from, you know, like reading the books about it and stuff like that.
No, I think it's wonderful. I think it's great. I mean, the more that, that people are educated about lowriders, the better, as far as I'm concerned. You know, lowriders had a negative stereotype for a long time. And I think finally that's getting over with.
What kind of negative stereotype?
Well, you know, the early movies were lowriders and they were all gangsters. That's all they drove. You know, you look at some of the videos, it's always just gangsters. You know, but I will give credit to Eazy-E and Snoop Dogg and all them that brought that actually brought the lowrider to the forefront and, you know, just blew it up in the 90s. I mean, just, you know, my business was built on those videos. People wanted those cars.
So the 90s were a good time for your business?
That was the golden age.
Well, Ben Chappell, take us through some of the history of lowriding. The whole thing started in Southern California, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not primarily a historian, and so that when people ask me about the history, I always can sketch out a few things. But my work has really been kind of the opposite direction, starting at in what was the present day at the time, and working back as much as I needed to understand what I was seeing. But
because Texas had its own particular relationship with the lowrider.
Oh, of course, of course. And Texas, you know, the relationship between Texas and California is always. I mean, there's a little bit of a rivalry there, but there's no doubt that lowriding started in California, and that's where it really developed. You know, a strong base. I think going back into the 40s, people were always customizing cars. Lowering the low look was very popular, you know, and in the Mexican-American barrios, and it was part of a larger aesthetic, you know, related to zoot suits and, you know, a whole just a whole idea about what looked good in people's home communities. And then in the 70s, it really was when people started talking about lowriders, and that specific identity became something that people would recognize.
Like when you heard that word?
That word. And leading up to Lowrider Magazine being established in the late 70s in Northern California, actually, in San Jose. And that, you know, Lowrider Magazine, they'll tell you they're the most successful Chicano publication of all time. And I'm sure that I'm sure they've got a case for that, because that magazine went everywhere. And, you know, there were people in El Paso who will tell you, well, we were driving low cars, you know, before Lowrider Magazine came to town or whatever. But, you know, these things spread by word of mouth. They spread through family. People move because of jobs or the military or something like that. And, you know, once you see somebody's car and you appreciate it, get curious, that's how it spreads.
According to the San Diego Automotive Museum, lowriding is an extension of a Mexican cultural custom called the paseo.
Yeah.
That young men and women would check each other out from opposite ends of a courtyard, and the guys would try to, like, one-up each other by decking out their horses. Is that right?
Well, that's what I call the paseo thesis. And, you know, a lot of people who have studied lowriders like to talk about that. And my perspective on it is, sure, why not? But, you know, the important thing about that, I think, is that it's all about streets and public places as social places. You know, a street is not just something for you to get through on your way to work or, you know, on your way to shop. It's a place where people come together. It's where they meet. So every community that has a low-riding tradition, you know, in Los Angeles, people talk about Whittier Boulevard. And, you know, and in Austin, where I was studying, it was Riverside. In San Antonio, it was military. You know, they've got their street where people come together. And, you know, that's where you meet your friends. That's where, you know, you try to court somebody. You might meet a spouse there. It happens. It's the social life of the community.
What is that street in Kansas City?
Well, there's a couple of them. I mean, back in the 90s, there was Nolan Road. The boulevard where my shop is at is real popular. And going up and down Prospect on a Sunday, people do that still.
Set the scene for me.
Well, you know, just you're sitting there on the street and you'll see from 1 to 20 cars just go by, and everyone's different, and everyone's got a different paint job and different rims. And I mean, it's an amazing scene. I mean, different styles. You got different styles now. People do Prospect that got the big rim cars, and, you know, just the little ricer cars. And, you know, it's just a car scene, you know.
What was the Nolan Road scene like?
Same thing. But, you know, as the police started, you know, cracking down on the cars, people quit going there so much. I really don't know what the scene is like there, but in the 90s, it was a real heavy cruise area.
Do you feel connected to the history we were just talking about, like you're part of a tradition, or?
Yeah, I feel like I feel like my family really, really helped the lowrider scene here in Kansas City. It was a small scene here when I jumped into it, and we started building our own hydraulic line and started hitting all the different lowrider shows and advertising. I think we really helped blow up lowriding here in Kansas City and the Midwest. Put our name in the books as a place that has lowriders. Lowrider Magazine came and had a couple of shows here. I offered up my help and, you know, to get, you know, whatever they needed to do a show here. And it's hard to get a lowrider show because they only do certain cities. And I got them to come here.
And sounds like that was a big deal. How did
big
it go?
Deal. Big deal. It was an amazing show. Great show. Great
what
show.
Year are we talking about?
Oh, man, you could show my age. It was in the mid-90s, 96, 97, 98, right around in there. I can't remember exactly what day it was, but it was in the 90s. And then I think we had another one in the 2000s. But yeah, it was a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
Tim, how does this all compare to what you saw in Texas? Because it sounds, we've hinted that Texas has its own relationship to this. And yeah, I'm curious about that.
Well, I mean, I think that Texas and Kansas are similar in a couple of ways. One being that in both places people did pick up this style, like Tim said, from seeing it in movies or from the magazine and things like that. It did spread out from California. The other thing,
like the magazine, Lowrider Magazine, is just impossible to ignore. It sounds like.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
That's the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, because when it started out, it was very much a community. Based publication. It was very independent, and the way they got their distribution was people would load up a box of magazines and drive, and they would drive all throughout the Southwest just spread it by word of mouth like that. So that was crucial. The other thing that I think the scene that I'm familiar with and what I'm learning about Kansas City is that these are places where Mexican Americans have been for a very long time. I'm so glad that Tim told us about his family background. People have been coming from Mexico to Kansas City for over 100 years. There's also a long history of that presence being ignored or erased. And I think that's so important for what gives lowriding its power, because this is a style that's associated with a particular community, a particular history. And like Tim described it, when a lowrider car is out in traffic, you cannot ignore it. It goes into a space and really changes that space. And that's what was so interesting to me, was to see how people would assert themselves and take their creations out into traffic and basically just say, we're here.
Tim, I mean, do you feel like it's important that there's now, I mean, this is the first year of the Kansas City, Kansas Latino Arts Festival, mm-hmm. and that there's a parade of lowriders as part of it. Does that mean something to you?
Oh, yeah, that's great. That's great. Again, we want nothing but positive. As lowriders, we want to show the community that there's other avenues how to live and how to be. That's wonderful that they're doing that. I love it. I mean, we used to do that. Like I said, I'm old school. There was a time where I wasn't too. I kind of got out of the game. Get married, kids, that kind of deal. But now I'm ready to get back into it. But there's new blood that's there. There's a friend of mine, Aaron Munoz. He's taking the forefront. That's who's doing a parade. I think that is amazing and wonderful that there's new people, younger people, that are trying to do the same thing that we tried to do back in the day.
I mean, it is hard to ignore perceptions of lowriders. Do you relate to what Ben was just saying about a history of being ignored and erased? And
Oh, yeah. I mean,
how have you personally felt that?
Well, there's in the history books, there's no mention of, Mexican Americans, doing what we've done all through the years is work hard, help build this country. We're part of this country. My family's part of this country. And, sometimes you just like to get acknowledged and say, hey, you guys are here. You guys contribute. Your culture's great. We love it. I mean, positive instead of all the negativity that's around nowadays.
Speaking of nowadays, I mean, everything it seems is political nowadays. Is lowriding political?
Well, if you get people on, more than five people in a group, of course, there's going to be some kind of politics. So, there's always some kind of politics in the car clubs and the car shows and that kind of deal. It's just the way it is when people get together.
What's your experience with that, Ben? Do you think low riding can be political?
Well,
just the act of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, what Tim's talking about is the kind of politics that a lot of low riders that I knew in car clubs would say. Let's just avoid the drama. Let's just keep it simple. You know, when I'm studying in Mexican American studies, politics means something a little bit different, and it doesn't just mean Democratic and Republican or city council politics, but more about this question of who gets recognized, about and you know who gets to define what a community is about. In Austin, where I did my research, this has been this is an issue that is ongoing because the East Side Barrio, which is you know a really important home, and the South Side as well, these were important locations for the Mexican American community, and that history is getting erased, it's getting wiped out, and so that's a political thing about you know who's recognized as belonging to the community, even names.
Like even- This sounds like in the context of gentrification.
Absolutely, gentrification. Yeah, and it's a combination of gentrification and also the sort of the public image of a place. Because when people talk about Austin, Texas, in other places, they'll say, "Oh, it's a great music scene," you know, whatever. But they don't often talk about the Mexican American community that's been there for so very long.
Tim, and, I mean, I wonder if you can relate to that on the West Side.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. You got Crossroads coming in. You got Power and Light. You got. You know, families moving out, they've been there for generations and generations. I mean, the Mexican-American community on the West Side is shrinking big time.
So is lowriding a part of maintaining visibility?
I'm never going to move. So there's always going to be a lowrider there. I mean, I'm not going anywhere.
Well, Tim Lona and Ben Chappell, thank you both so much for coming in today. It's been fascinating.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Thank you.
The first ever Kansas City, Kansas Latino Arts Festival and Parade is this weekend. The parade begins Saturday at noon at 4th in Minnesota. Up next, the politics of 2016 and 2017 in high school yearbooks. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we've got a bunch of high schoolers with us to talk about how their yearbooks handled the politics of the past year. Because let's face it, if you're capturing the spirit of 2016 and 2017, politics are going to be hard to ignore. But should yearbooks actually get political? I mean, they're for everyone in the whole school. And you don't want to make a keepsake that's alienating or divisive. So let's hear about some different approaches at local schools. Lainey Duckworth is with us from Shawnee Mission East. She was a designer on the yearbook this year, and she'll be the editor next year. Hi, Lainey.
Hi.
So why did you join the yearbook staff? What was the yearbook about to you?
Well, I kind of just joined on a whim, but really I just wanted to find another way to get involved and learn more about my school. And yearbook really is a great way to do that because you're getting to know so many different people from every aspect of your school. And yeah, it's been a really good experience.
Did you start out as a freshman on the yearbook?
Well, you can join sophomore year at my school. So I joined as soon as I could.
And so what's your knowledge of how previous years handled politics? Was there any need to do that previously?
Yeah, well, I've looked in previous yearbooks, and I know in the 2012 book, they did do an election spread, and we've never been one to shy away from covering politics because it is does play a really large role in the lives of our students. But this year, we covered the election, the Women's March, but we just want to make sure we can get all students' opinions so it definitely doesn't alienate anyone.
Does Shawnee Mission East feel like a politically diverse student body, or do most of the kids lean one way or the other?
Yeah, I would say we're pretty diverse politically. It's definitely leans more liberal because I just think most young people tend to skew that way. But there are definitely very vocal people on both ends of the spectrum.
So when November rolled around, had you guys had discussions about how to cover the election?
Yeah, well, we had already started our election spread prior to the election actually happening. So we had an idea. But we really wanted to show how our own students were involved in the election. So we did stories about students who worked on campaigns. So we had a story about a student who worked on Yoder's campaign and another one who worked on Hillary's campaign. So we really just wanted to show how our students got involved and how they made a difference, even though most of them can't vote.
What was the election like for you personally?
Well, personally, I think I was surprised as anyone. I was personally disappointed in the results because I had wanted Clinton to win, but I definitely didn't let that affect my yearbook work because, I mean, you have to just show how your student body reacts, most importantly, and how it is to them. Was it hard to leave that behind when you came to school the next day and had to get back to work on the yearbook being your unbiased self?
I would say at the beginning, I was definitely, it was kind of like, oh, I want to move on from this now. But I did really want to show how it affected our student body. So I was able to just put that aside and just work with my co-designer to make sure we could just make an accurate spread that showed, I mean, our student body and their views rather than ours.
Do you and your co-designer share the same politics?
Yeah, it was actually pretty interesting because he was a Republican and I wanted Clinton to win. So it was probably, I think, good that way because we were able to balance each other out and say, oh, maybe like if we're going to talk about the Trump tape, we should also talk about the email scandal to kind of have that balance on both sides so that it was an even coverage.
You had this two-page spread that included individual students giving the election results a grade and a one-word description. And some of the words were things like either disappointing or bold, hectic, chaotic, or hectic, I think it was unique. And each student graded the election. But were students reluctant to have their photos with a political label in the yearbook, or were they eager to identify and put themselves out there that way?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting because one of the people we did reach out to actually told us she wasn't comfortable with being in the yearbook openly with her political viewpoints, but we made sure that everyone was comfortable with that because a lot of people just aren't comfortable putting that out there. But there definitely was some apprehension about being that vocal about your political viewpoints in the yearbook.
What do you think it was about the yearbook in particular? Like, I mean, you could put your viewpoints out there by wearing a button while you're walking down the hall, or maybe by having yourself being profiled in the student newspaper. But the yearbook is this thing that lasts way into the future, or it's supposed to anyway. Do you think that's different?
I definitely do, because that is something that you'll look back on for years to come and your kids will probably look at. So
there's no denying where you stood back when you were in high school.
Mm-hmm. And I think just that the fact that the whole student body is going to see this at the end of the year was another reason that some people were kind of apprehensive about that.
Well, let's hear another approach. Drew Sims is with us from North Kansas City, where he worked on the yearbook for Staley High School. Hi, Drew.
Hi.
Does Staley's yearbook have a name?
Yeah, it's the Legacy Yearbook. That's just what we came up with the first year it opened.
How had the Legacy been thinking about the politics of this year's election before November 8th?
We decided kind of how we were going to cover the election throughout our yearbook was our theme itself is called United. We wanted to kind of spin it off of how there was an election this year because that was the main thing that everyone was talking about this year. So we wanted it to kind of be like, even though our nation's divided based off like conservative and liberal and stuff, still as a school, we were united throughout all these different activities that we did and stuff. And I think we decided on covering the mock election that we had at our school as an easy way to just say, to keep, I guess, keep it unbiased as completely as we could and just show how the school voted in the mock election.
Were you able to pull that off? Because, I mean, you're kind of describing that, okay, the whole country is being one way about this, but in our yearbook, we're going to present it in this other way. Like, the nation's divided. In our yearbook, we will be united. The nation, like, national politics are one way, but we're going to focus on the mock election, which some... and try to keep it separate from all of that. Was it able to stay separate? Was it able to stay united?
It was definitely harder with the election coverage because there's obviously division in our school on who you supported and stuff. But we wanted to, throughout the rest of the book, we would ask players on sports teams and stuff how they felt their team was united based on like team bonding activities and stuff like that. And so we had we had pages dedicated to activities that we as a school did and stuff so that you can just look back in 20 or 30 years and see, oh yeah, we had a lot of fun together as a school. And for this like certain activity and like football games and basketball games and stuff, we could just forget about how different we are and sometimes and how we all go to the same school and we're all pretty much like a little family.
So can you see the political divisions of the nation at all when you look back at this 2016-2017 yearbook?
On our election spread, the main story was just about the mock election. And in the mock election, our student body voted for Trump. It was only like 20% of the student body that voted. But so that we had our coverage of Trump there. And then we wanted to make sure that everyone was included. So we covered the Women's March in Kansas City. We had teachers and students who were active in that. And then other than that, we asked students who they would have voted for if it wasn't Trump or Hillary, who, like, anyone in the world that they would have voted for. People said, like, their mom or Michelle Obama and stuff. So we just wanted to make sure that everyone was included and everyone's views were shown on that page.
Did the mock election have any kind of aftermath, like the real one?
I know, like, after they announced it and stuff, people kind of talked about it. They announced it at the very end of the day, so it wasn't like a, we had the rest of the day just to discuss it and stuff. It was like, we were listening to the announcements at the end of the day, and we were like, they announced that Trump won, and people were all like, oh, that's disappointing, or people were like really excited about it and stuff. But other than that, it was never really brought up, just because the mock election was held before the actual election. So after the mock election was held, we just kind of went right back towards the actual election. That was the main talk at the school.
Was there an aftermath to the actual election in your school?
Actually, we went on a journalism trip to Indianapolis the day after the election, so I wasn't in the school the day after the election. But I know on our trip, it was like the only thing we talked about. We had people who were happy about it, people who were disappointed about it and stuff, and it was just pretty much that entire trip we were there, we always talked about. We didn't want it to let us affect our trip so much or anything like that, but like it was definitely talked about.
Would it have been possible to just ignore politics in your yearbook this year?
I think if you could always ignore politics, but you're definitely going to have to, especially in an election year, your yearbook is your history book. In 20 to 30 years, you're going to want to look back and see how the election affected your school. And I just feel like, you know, it's probably a good reason or a good way to include everyone's views in the yearbook.
We'll bring one more student in on this discussion after the break, some perspective from Lincoln Prep. We'd love to hear from you, too. Did you graduate in a politically tumultuous year? How did your yearbook handle it? And what does that political coverage mean to you now through the lens of nostalgia? I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about yearbooks with local high schoolers, specifically how yearbooks handled the politics of the past year. We've heard from students at Shawnee Mission East and Staley High School, and now we're joined by Ayana Belk. She's the business manager for the yearbook at Lincoln Prep. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So tell me about your school.
So Lincoln College Prep is it's a great school. It's on 21st and Whitland in the Kansas City area. We're predominantly, well, historically Black school, but we also have a large Hispanic population and a bit of Muslims and a small white population.
Why did you want to work on the yearbook? What do you think that your yearbook means to the kids at your school and to you?
I joined yearbook in my junior year because that was as soon as I can get into it. Our yearbook is titled The Lincolnian, and it's kind of like, I don't know, it's lost its importance over the years, kind of, because we've kind of turned to social media and the internet. But it's important to me because of, like, our pictures, and I wanted to make sure everyone looked as good as possible and make sure that we put as much information into our yearbook as possible. So that's kind of why I joined.
So the yearbook feels different to people now that there's social media, which is kind of perpetually like, hey, look who's who.
Yeah.
I can imagine that. But how do politics fit into a yearbook to you?
I haven't been paying attention for the past few election years to see how we covered politics, but I know this year we weren't so keen on putting the full results and making anyone say anything that they weren't too proud of. So this year we kind of turned away from politics and we kind of focused our big news section on like entertainment and social media and things like that.
Did anyone object to that, or did it feel like, yeah, we'd all kind of rather ignore this?
Well, the yearbook staff was more keen on, like, ignoring the situation. We didn't get much feedback from our students since we passed out our yearbooks the day of our seniors' last day of school. So no one really got to gather information on how people felt about the way we decided to cover our politics. But I think people were kind of in agreement with this since we decided to cover the Women's March and people holding "I'm with her" signs and things like that. So I think it's okay.
How did... how did the political climate feel in general in the halls of Lincoln Prep leading up to the election?
I know there was kind of like a discourse a little bit because we were kind of concerned about the way the country was turning. I know in a lot of our classes, we kind of had to watch the news, like in our current events class and in our multicultural studies class, we had to kind of watch the news and watch a lot of speeches and debates and things like that. So that kind of made us think about politics, but we weren't really like proud of what was going on or the way it was like leading up to the election. We weren't really happy with it.
So like as a whole, you feel like the student body was pretty united in not liking what was going on?
Yeah, from what I can tell.
What was it about what was going on?
It was kind of about the way that Trump was kind of using the media and the way that he was talking about certain ethnic groups that were represented in the school. Like a lot of us were kind of concerned about our families. A lot of us were kind of concerned about each other. We didn't really like the fact that people were giving him so much attention over Hillary. And we were kind of like concerned about just the way that he was so present. And we didn't really want people to see that because we were seeing it and we weren't really... A lot of us weren't at the age to vote, so we were kind of concerned about people that were at the age to vote, like college students and our parents, and how they were just seeing him all the time, and no one was really thinking about the other options and the other candidates. So just from those classes, we were kind of just a little concerned about it.
How did that concern spill over into conversations about planning for the yearbook? Did it?
Yeah. So initially, we decided to do a two-page spread, a layout, about like solely on politics, because like we did that previously for the Royals when they won the World Series. But after the results came out, we decided to just do like a little snippet to just show like people's heads with like captions about the politics and not to really go too deep into it.
So like a person's image with a caption about how that person felt?
Yeah, like people holding like "I'm with her" signs, and it would just say like, oh, so-and-so decided to go to the march, and so-and-so like supports the like Clinton campaign and all that. We didn't really want to like fully show like a full poll or like a full record or like snippets of like riots or protests or anything. We kind of just wanted to like lightly mention the politics.
So you pulled back from some bigger plans based on the results?
Yeah.
Do you think that it sounds like the other schools we've heard about, maybe the politics were a little more divided. Do you think that everyone being on the same page, at least from your perspective, made that an easy call?
I think it was more focused on the yearbook committee's like feelings like about us, because like we didn't really have a mock election or anything like that. We didn't really take a poll about how people felt about our coverage or about how people felt about the actual election or anything. We kind of just wanted to put our own spin on it, so we decided that we should just pull back in general, just because we didn't know how people really felt. We just kind of assumed that we were all like liberal or something, and we didn't really want to like say something, like we didn't want to overstep. We didn't want to say that everyone's feeling this way, everyone's feeling that way. So we just kind of just mentioned it and just let it be.
It sounds like you also kind of, felt like you could follow your own hearts about how you wanted to talk about it. And
so we kind of just went like that, just because we didn't want to hurt anyone with being like, with like this reminder that, oh yeah, like Trump won, because I felt that we all weren't really supportive of Trump. So we didn't want to like put that down in the book and have that passed down like from generation to generation, talking about this one thing that we weren't really in love with.
So afraid that this would be a painful reminder in the future?
Yeah, we kind of wanted our yearbook to be like really joyful and happy and about things like that were happening at Lincoln's. We can remember what high school was like. We didn't really want to talk about like the world problems, because there'll be plenty of reminders about that later.
I wonder if our other yearbook editors can relate to some of this. I mean, no matter which side you were on politically, the divisiveness of this time, or at least what most people consider a pretty divided time, is there a painful reminder in that?
I would say that, I mean, I can't really consider it a painful reminder, because I don't want to speak for my whole school, because like I was saying earlier, my school does have a lot of different opinions, but I think we tried to focus more on our own students, so it's not as much focused on the actual results as much as how they played a role. So I wouldn't...
So like the engagement is positive
even if there is division.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, at least they're getting involved in their community and elections and getting that experience. And we did include the results from both the actual election and the mock election, but it wasn't as much of a focus as how our own students got involved and how the election affected their discussions with their peers and things like that.
What are your thoughts, Drew?
Yeah, kind of the same thing. Like, we decided really, you know, just 20 to 30 years from now, when people look back at their yearbooks, we want them to see how their school was active in the election process and stuff. Instead of just covering the election itself, we wanted everyone to see, like, that's why we covered the mock election. That's why we had people covering the women's march. We wanted everyone just to look back and be able to see that that's how their school was active in it, and not just solely on how the election itself was, the results from that.
Ayana, do you think, I mean, what do you think accounts for, I don't know, it seems like maybe you were a little more reluctant to dive into politics.
Yeah, I'd say for the most part at my school, we weren't too into politics like we were. Just for the fact that a lot of us on the staff, we have about 60% of our staff being juniors, and a lot of them can't vote. So we weren't really too focused on politics this year as a whole. We were kind of focused on our trip to New York and like other things that we just didn't want to like bother like learning about to put into the yearbook. We know that politics are very important, but it kind of came out while we were thinking about it that a couple of our teachers were actually kind of Republican, and that we didn't want to like get into that. We didn't want to like out anyone basically at our school. So we're just kind of like, let's just leave it alone. And politics are really important, like for the future and for the past and everything. But in our yearbook, we already had like a set way of how we wanted to report things. So we went ahead and went that direction instead of stepping into politics, stepping into something new that hadn't really been historically like written down in our yearbooks before.
You know, that is interesting because we've heard about focusing on what specific students did and didn't do. And with this need to not leave anyone out, I mean, that does maybe leave out people who, I don't know, don't want to be public about their politics.
Yeah, I definitely get that. We did send out a big poll that the yearbook did separate from the mock election. So that was anonymous. So we did think that people could voice their opinions that way. And we talked to a lot of our peers about it. So I feel like there was a pretty good idea about how the student body felt, but obviously we can't generalize. But I do think you just need to be aware of what the students are comfortable with. And if they're not comfortable with talking about politics, I wouldn't want to ever push them into doing that.
Have you gotten any reaction yet? I mean, your yearbook, the Shawnee Mission East yearbook, was covered in the New York Times.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. Had people mention it to me, mention the yearbook being covered in the New York Times, like you said. But I think it's more about how our student body reacts, because they're, at the end of the day, our audience, and they're the people that we want to have this time capsule of what the year was like. And kind of like a Lincoln, we give out our yearbook on the seniors' last day, so there's not a ton of feedback, but we've generally had pretty positive feedback because I think we try and give a full picture of our student body.
Ayana, when you saw your yearbook, how did you feel personally? Because it seems like, yeah, this has been important to you.
I think the yearbook itself was very beautiful. Our cover held like components of like school art and like student art, and it was very just filled with a lot of personal like decisions that people made this year, and we kind of wanted to stick with that thing. We didn't really want to focus on the world. We kind of wanted to keep it locked tight on Lincoln and what Lincoln is about. So,
Drew, how did you feel when you saw your yearbook?
Our yearbook actually isn't done. It's a fall release book, so like my staff is still at school right now trying to finish the book as much as we can.
And what about you?
I think it's such a cool experience to actually get to hold your work, and so I was really happy with the yearbook and how it turned out. Just to see your work in paper and in hardcover is such a cool experience that I mean, just in high school journalism is something that's really special.
Lainey Duckworth, Ayana Belk, and Drew Sims, thank you all so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to our discussions about yearbooks in a politically divisive time and lowriders in Kansas City at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, an exciting look ahead to the arts in town this June, from a reggae festival to a letter writing club. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.